Next year, Heritage Radio Network is turning 10. For the last decade, we've been committed to bringing listeners around the world the very best in food radio, for free. Our small staff and incredible network of hosts work hard so that listeners can tune in each week to hear the important conversations in food policy, stay on the cutting edge of cocktail culture, and hear the latest updates in food tech. But there is no HRN without the support of listeners like you. Become a member of Heritage Radio Network today and help HRN get a strong start to our second decade. Choose from exclusive member gifts and stay in the loop on discounts to upcoming events. There's no better time to show your support. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and wish HRN a happy birthday.
Hi, Bomb Squad. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Each week, we bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life through conversations with the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. Welcome to our final show of 2018. Before we get started, I have one last favor to ask. I'd love for you to leave a comment on whatever platform you listen to the show through and let us know who you would like to hear on Radio Cherry Bomb next year. Help us make 2019 the best year of Radio Cherry Bomb yet. First, let's thank our sponsors. Le Cordon Bleu. If you're daydreaming about culinary school, maybe 2019 is the time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplôme, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. And let's thank Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs. Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs are better than cage-free. They are bullshit free. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. And Bob's Red Mill. Bob's Red Mill is an employee-owned company that's been offering organic, gluten-free, and stone-ground products for decades. Go to bobsredmill.com and use the code CHERRYBOMB25 for 25% off your order. To all the people behind those brands, thank you for supporting Cherry Bomb. It is such a gift to be able to host this show, and it's a privilege I don't take lightly. Thank you for the financial support, which lets us tell the stories of so many incredible women each week. I was looking through all the shows from this year, and I can't believe we recorded more than 40 episodes. I really can't. If you're new to the show, there's plenty for you to binge listen to if you get a break this holiday season. So many wonderful, warm, inspiring people. Chef Libby Willis of Mimi's Cafe, Chef Deborah Van Treese from Atlanta, Sharon Richardson of Just Soul Catering, she's an activist for the formerly incarcerated, supermodel Elle McPherson, my heroes Ruth Rogers of The River Cafe, and Lynn Rosetto Casper, the retired host of The Splendid Table. We remembered legends like Edna Lewis and Anthony Bourdain. If I had to pick some favorite shows, which is really hard, but I would probably say Jen Pelka's show about how she raised the money from 33 different women to open The Riddler, her champagne bar in San Francisco. We got so many emails about that show. And I also loved a show I did in April with wine and travel expert Cha McCoy and the Venice, Italy-based blogger and cookbook author Skye McAlpine. It was such an unexpected delight. I didn't really know either woman before the interview, and when we finished, I felt like I had two new friends. We sat outside at Roberta's, where we recorded that episode, and enjoyed the beautiful weather, a pizza, and some wine. If either of them had said, hey, let's all hop on a plane to Italy, I would have said, ciao, Brooklyn, and headed to JFK. Seriously. So let's talk about today's show. We're calling this show the Lost Episode because, well, we did this recording back in April, and it went missing. Suffice to say, it's a long story. But here we are, 8 months later. The first half of the show features an interview I did with Jen Ag, Toronto restaurateur and author of an autobiography called I Hear She's a Real Bitch. Great title, right? Jen is a fantastic writer and a passionate human being, and talking to her is never boring. I need to give you a little backstory first. Jen was in New York because she was on a panel at our Jubilee conference in April. The panel was moderated by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Kim Severson, and let's say She and Jen were not on the same page regarding an article Kim wrote for the New York Times about Mario Batali and his comeback attempt. The panel wound up being fairly heated, no surprise, as it centered around the difficult issues of Me Too. If you haven't read the Batali story, you might want to read it to understand what we're talking about and to see how you feel about it. It's good to have Jen on the show as we close out the year because part of our conversation is a reminder that much has changed, but much hasn't, and a lot of work remains to be done regarding harassment and equality in the food world. One sobering thought, none of the men accused of harassment have divested from their restaurant groups. They've talked about it, but none has actually moved forward and done it. The second half of the show features my friend Christine Barbaric, the global editor-in-chief and co-founder of Refinery29. Christine joins us to reminisce about her days at the legendary Gourmet magazine. We'll be right back with Jen Ag after this word from Le Cordon Bleu. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and pâtisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin. I want to talk about the article, though, because I understand why people are upset about the article, but I saw different things in that article. I did not see a sympathetic character in Mario. I saw someone who looked really pathetic.
Oh, sure. That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I agree that you know, he does look pathetic in that no matter what. But I think there's a few lines like world kicked out from under him mm-hmm. that should just have been edited in a completely different way. Mm-hmm. Like that automatically sets this person up as a victim. When there's that stranger quote of like, I don't want to do it injustice. It's something to the effect of, you know, this, it's time for a more nuanced approach. Like there were not enough quotes to support the other perspective here. And there were no quotes from victims, which...
Can I tell you the other things, though?
Yeah,
that
of
I
course.
Liked about the story?
Yeah.
I liked that Kim or the New York Times or whomever is keeping that story alive, because I think one of the big dangers is that it seems like it's part of this like crazy Trumpian news cycle where things happen and they just disappear because things are happening so fast you just can't pay attention to everything. And I think it's important that the story does not disappear. I also think it serves as a cautionary tale to guys who are still creeps and assholes and harassers.
Oh, guys aren't like that anymore. Everybody's better now.
Because you know there are a lot of guys who think it'll just go away. Things will change. I also like the fact that they pointed out that he is trying to redeem himself on the backs of women. He thinks he's going to like get women to clean up his mess. I was so outraged by that. And I was like, how dare he create this giant mess and now think women are going to clean it up for him? And I was really happy that the New York Times enlightened us about that. And I think women need to watch out that guys are going to use them to make things better for them.
I mean, we see it differently, but I understand what you're saying.
You said something really interesting during the conference, because one of the things that Kim brought up, and it was inevitable, was about April Bloomfield mm-hmm. and what's been happening with April's organization and her partner, Ken. And you said something about just burning these places down. And I don't think
metaphorically.
You didn't mean like strike a match
clearly.
And burn them down. But what were you talking about in that sense?
I mean, I still am kind of working through my own ideas of how I think culturally we should move forward. And I spend a lot of time talking with a lot of smart women about this. Part of me, of course, understands the perspectives of you know, don't punish the staff, let the staff continue on. But what does that actually look like? That is a very pat kind of tie it up in a bow and move on. And it's very much like we were talking about, wrap it up and go away. Because don't punish the staff. Like, has the staff now formed a co-op and they've purchased, you know, Grabby Pants, like out of his shares for a price that, you know, dishwashers and bartenders can afford? Like, that actually doesn't make any sense to me, because ultimately, your money is still going into this person's pocket.
And that at the end of the day is the problem I have.
Economically, I mean, that the only, it's always economic. The only way we can make a change, really, it's always about money. So yeah, for me, that doesn't make any sense. And we do have a serious staffing crisis in the restaurant industry in my country. I hear about it all the time in your town. So yeah, there's other jobs. Go get the other jobs.
I totally hear you, but
I'm quite radical that
way. No, I know you are. I know you are. But I just dropping everything and finding another job isn't that easy.
No, it's not. I understand that. But I'm not sure that I can see the better solution.
Yeah.
And I have not had it presented to me by anyone I respect.
One of the messages that came through to me as part of that whole panel that there's so many other places to focus on and so many other places to work and so many other good people. But we shouldn't necessarily stop talking about those other places because then that just doesn't solve the problem.
I think it does solve the problem in some ways.
To just stop talking
just,
about
them.
Yeah,
it's like advertising. You know, you ignore someone, they go away. If you ignore Batali, he doesn't exist anymore. That is actually probably the cruelest punishment for a man like that who is clearly an egoist.
Okay, I hear that.
Yeah. I just thought of that right now. I know, they're just like riffing on ideas. No, but I think that historically, we haven't been the people that are being focused on. You know, I'm a Canadian woman, and it took me like a huge scrapping and scraping and fighting my way to the top of my industry. And maybe, you know, a small percentage of your industry and your country kind of know who I am because of huge efforts put in. And I don't think I would have had that same struggle as a dude with similar characteristics. Mm-hmm. I could say probably not.
So let's then tell the audience a little bit about you. How did you get into the restaurant business?
I didn't want a boss. And I, you know, that seemed as a young woman, 18 years old, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, et cetera, that seemed like the quickest way to not have a boss. I was really good at this. It really combined skill sets that I was, you know, had mastered or whatever, however you want to put it, just people skills, you know, that's what I'm known for, really, my people skills. But talking to people, psychology, that's really what serving is. And if you can also do that while balancing plates and learn how to walk and learn how to be in a room and just have common fucking sense, that was it for me. And I loved everything about it. And every day is the same but different, mm-hmm. which is exciting for somebody who has a short attention span.
Where did you grow up?
Scarborough, which is a suburb of Toronto.
And what was it like there? Same as the suburbs in
America? It was like any suburb, anywhere. Made you want to get out.
And what was your family like?
White people. White suburban people. They were great. You know, both my parents are dead, which is really shitty. But yeah, I'm a lot more like my dad. My brother's a lot more like my mom. There's that kind of dividing line. But they really just kind of, I think, realized early on that they weren't going to have the control of me that they maybe would have wanted to, and that it was easier sometimes just to let me live than it was to try and control me.
Was your mom a working mom or stay-at-home mom?
No, working mom. Both mm-hmm. my parents were teachers.
Mm-hmm. And how did Gen Ag become Gen Ag?
Well, I mean, I think genetics play a role. Like my dad, one of my favorite stories about my dad is he grew up dirt poor, like dirt floor poor. And when he met my mom, he was embarrassed to bring her to the house. It all turned out to be fine, but he worked his way through university, and this very like rich person university in Canada called Western. And he was like peeling potatoes in the kitchen, you know, hours a day to pay for his tuition and any other sort of odd job he could pick up. But he tells me that he would, and it's funny because he had Alzheimer's, and he didn't tell me the story until kind of into the Alzheimer's, when there's this thing that happens where the walls start to kind of crumble a little bit. And so you kind of see that person in Technicolor for a year or two or however long it lasts. And then things take a much worse turn. But he would stand there in the kitchen peeling potatoes, looking out at all these like preppy rich boys and just be like, I'm going to leave you bastards in the dust. So, I mean, certainly there is some of that in me. And I think that's a big part of it. I mean, I think, you know, I talk about it in my book, so it's kind of a spoiler. So just like earmuffs if you want to read my book, and you definitely
should.
Which
you all do.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that there's something to be said for like being born with one tit. Like that's you know, being a teenager and trying to negotiate your body and just wanting to be naked all the time and worrying about more than like a muffin top, it's a serious thing. And I think it made me really tough. You know, it's like getting surgery at 17 or 16 or however old I was, like it probably really marked me. And, mm-hmm. and it, I think, made me even more of the genetic fighter that I was sort of programmed to be.
So, were you always a feminist?
I mean, I think certainly, yes. Like, I don't think I performed feminism that well as a teenager, you know, but I think that had a lot to do with internalized misogyny and just wanting to be on the winning team and thinking boys were cooler because that's what I'm programmed to think, and all of that garbage that you have to unlearn as you start reading books and like understanding how the world works.
So fast forward, how did you become an owner of your places?
So I owned a bar in my 20s with my starter husband. And that was like, you know, overall a success in that it lasted 8 years, and 8 years is a fairly good life for a bar. Less successful was that I ended up $300,000 in debt to the Canadian government, and they want their money just as much as your American government does. And so I
thought you had this really nice government. But...
yeah, no. So they wanted their money real bad. So I had really no choice. Everything was in my name, which because my parents were like, make sure you put the business in your name. Like, thanks. Like, how about make sure you fucking incorporate? That is a good lesson. And so I had all of this money that I couldn't pay. So I had to declare bankruptcy at 29 years old. And I remember very clearly how humiliating that was. I had been dating my current husband and forever husband, like, there's not going to be like a third husband. This is it. And we'd been dating for about a year, like long enough that I was comfortable telling him these like horrible money problems I was having. And he was going through his divorce. He'd been separated for a couple years, but they hadn't finalized the divorce. And they owned this building on Dundas, which is where The Hoof is now. But it was where his design store, Cocktail Molotov, was. It's a lot of like tangential details, but you should just read the book. So he ended up selling the building, and all of the money that he made from that, which was $70,000 after everything was all paid off and lawyer fees and blah, 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 divorces are expensive, he invested every last dime in my crazy idea. And I've been called somebody who has a sugar daddy for that story, which I think is insane, because now he gets to paint every day and do whatever he wants because he made that very smart investment. So I sort of look at it like both of us putting each other through school in some way, that like when you love someone, then you support them in all ways.
So what did you learn from the first place that didn't work out that you applied
always
to that you applied to the next place?
Yeah, definitely. Always incorporate. Like that was really, really ridiculous that I didn't.
But you must have run them differently.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I mean, I was young. I was in my 20s. I had no business really being a boss. And, you know, a lot of my staff were around my age or some, in some cases older. And it was just a mess, but it was a beautiful mess. I loved it. And I think definitely one thing that Roland always, that's my husband, always says is that I look at the money really closely now. Like I'm always checking in and seeing what's happening in the businesses. And I probably didn't do that as much when I was younger.
What are some other things? We have a lot of entrepreneurs who listen to the show.
You know, being a boss comes sort of naturally. So it's really kind of a hard question for mm-hmm. me to answer. Like, how do I do it? I mean, for one thing, I probably went at the beginning of The Hoof, which is now almost 10 years ago, which is crazy, being kind of a micromanagey control freak and wanting everything to be a certain way. And I've gone from that to, you know, trusting my managers but also like having built those managers up from, you know, a lot of the people that have worked for me, with me, it's been five or 10 years. And really trusting them and learning to let go a little bit. That was like a huge turning point for me probably about 5 years ago. And understanding that my role in the company as like a captain or a leader or whatever, it was very important for me to focus on that and let them focus on the details. So I think it would have been a lot easier for me at the beginning to not run myself into a bronchial underweight illness from like working all the time. Yeah, don't do that.
So in terms of running your places as a boss who wants to do things the right way and not, you want to treat your employees fairly, you don't want harassment to take place when your back is turned.
Nope.
What have you put in place to make sure that that happens?
You know, I've been asked this question a lot in the last few months, and I think it's really important. For me, it's very simple. I don't have a huge company. I mean, we probably employ, I don't know, 70 or 100 people. And
it's pretty impressive.
I guess it is. Yeah, I don't know. It's something. Maybe it's like, I don't really know the number, but it's gatekeeping for me. It's trusting your gut. It's when you sit down and interview somebody, if they give you a bad feeling, like follow up, call their past employers, see what's up with that bad feeling. Watch them if you, for some reason, feel like you should hire someone who gives you a bad feeling, which I would never do. And I think maybe not everyone's great at trusting their gut or has a gut that deserves to be trusted. So, I mean, that's not really an answer. That's what works for me. We have systems in place in terms of like if something happens and you're working on the floor, you can go right to a manager. And like that happened at Grey Gardens not too long ago. We had a customer made one of our food runners feel uncomfortable. And really, unfortunately, she didn't tell us about it until after it had happened. And we made it very, very clear to her that, like, should this ever happen again, you have to tell us while it's happening so that we can deal with it. So, yeah, I mean, I think everybody knows that they can come to me with stuff. People have come to me with stuff, so I know that they feel comfortable.
Let's talk about your book.
Okay.
So the title of the book is I Hear She's a Real Bitch. How did you come up with the title? That's an original question. I'm sure you've been asked that.
No, never,
times.
Actually. So I was out for dinner with friends, and I think I don't really remember. I wanted to have something that sort of hinted at the perception about me and not what I think I am, but what I think other people think I am. And we were sort of batting around whether it was I heard or I hear. And one of my friends was like, no, it's like urgent. You can't use past tense. It has to be present. And it just like settled. And it was just, to me, there was no other title. There was nothing else I could call the book except for that.
Why do you think that's people's perception of you?
I think because, you know, A, I say what I think religiously. I don't back down from a fight. I'm not scared to take on people who have more power than I do. I try not to punch down. I don't think people are used to women who actually say what they think. The hypocrisy levels, you know, that we have to deal with just as a culture, that how we all deal with each other, smiles and then knife in the back. I fucking hate it. I hate it. I would rather just somebody tell me how they feel and then we can deal with that. And that's not most people.
A lot of it, I think, has to do with the hospitality industry because it is supposed to be all smiles and positivity and, you know, if being this sort of truth teller, they don't really go hand in hand.
You're not wrong. It's something I think about all the time. And I know that that's sort of what people think is the first blood I've drawn, but it's actually not true because I'm very hospitable and my staff is very hospitable. And the moment you're in the door at my restaurant, you're having a wonderful time. Like we make getting in the door a reasonable and lovely thing. Unlike so many places in this town, please feel free to wait outside. No, we don't call or text. Are you kidding me? Like it's like minus five. Like it's crazy to me. I understand the logic of it, of like bums in seats all the time. Like I get it. But if you're good at hosting, you can have bums in seats all the time and text your guests and let them know. Anyway, so that's another thing. So I'm really hospitable and I think a lot about hospitality. And I'm also a kind person by nature. But if somebody draws the first blood from me, that is where I feel free to kind of open the door and let her rip, so to speak. It all comes from a good place, but I think sometimes people don't like my approach or they find me too abrasive or are too sweary or whatever.
So tell me about your places. I'm sorry I haven't been to Toronto in years.
That's okay.
I haven't been to them, but...
What do you want to know?
You don't have a favorite, but tell me about the different places and like what...
You do? Yeah, I'm not going to tell you guys, okay. But yeah, of course. Everybody has a favorite child. They just can't admit it.
But walk us through your empire.
So the Hoof was the firstborn, if you will allow this terrible restaurant as children's metaphor. And then Cocktail Bar was built really as an annex. And I was just tweeting about this today, that you can't or should not rather annex your business with something that cannot swim on its own. So Cocktail Bar really has its own heartbeat now. But it was, you know, the original purpose was go away to Cocktail Bar because, you know, it's Canada and the winters are long.
Tell us about the foods.
The Hoof is a charcuterie restaurant. So we make all of our own salumi, any kind of sort of pâtés. Like, so the charcuterie board is the baseline for the restaurant. And then sweetbreads, foie gras, it's sort of meat heavy. But we also have like pasta and veg. There's kind of something for everyone. It's a very good restaurant. I am obviously biased, but I think 10 years of putting out really good food and providing good service and kind of setting a line in Toronto for that kind of stuff. And I feel very proud of that.
And why the name the Black Hoof? What does that come from?
Pata Negra. So the ham.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was
the pigs that are fed the acorns.
Exactly.
And yes. 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 Okay. And then cocktail bar.
Cocktail bar. So that was go wait a cocktail bar while you're waiting for your table, because we don't take reservations, which was a new thing for Toronto when we started doing it, but now it's very common. Although people are now pivoting hard back to reservations. But I kind of like the idea that you can just always get a table. Like, it might take a little while, or there's might be some planning involved. And cocktail bar is like just really good cocktails. Long menu, maybe 26 or so. There's funny little descriptions that actually are funny with every drink. And yeah, the bartenders are great. They have a lot of freedom. It's great.
Snacks? Just drinks?
Just like light snacks, like shrimp cocktail, oysters, okay. That kind of thing. And then came Rum Corner. And that sort of grew out of my husband, Roland, spending time in cocktail bar with a bottle of Barbancourt, which is the rum of Haiti, and some Mexican Coke because it has real sugar and tastes better, and a little, you know, a little glass of limes. And he'd put on, we usually play jazz, cocktail bar, blah, blah, blah. And he'd put on Haitian music and have some of our friends would come by and he'd like give them rum and Cokes so they wouldn't spend the money at cocktail bar, which is like a lovely thing, but also in a 26-seat bar, not an ideal situation. And, you know, I'd ask my staff, like, where's Roland? I'd be like, oh, he's in the Rum Corner, which is how we came up for the name. And it's great. It's like a totally fun bar, restaurant, Haitian food, all Haitian music. Roland plays live bal. It's like music recorded off the floor. Almost exclusively, like, that's the challenge he likes to give himself, to only play.
Is he Haitian?
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. That'd be insane. Yeah. I'm just this, like, white lady with some non-Haitian husband opening a Haitian restaurant. Yes, he's definitely
Weirder
Haitian.
Things have happened.
Well, no, they happen all the time, but I just think they're wrong.
Okay, next.
Oh, next. So there's, like, those are the trifecta, and that's really, that's the heart of the company in that sense. Like, the Hoof and Rum are right beside each other. They share a party wall. And then across the street, almost in a perfect V, is Cocktail Bar. And then about a 10-minute walk east of there in Kensington Market, beautiful Kensington Market, is Grey Gardens. And it is really my swan song. It's like what I was able to do when I had a little more money, although I'm super proud of building it for like way...
Not your swan song in the sense that that's the last thing you're going to do.
I know that's what it technically means, but that's how I felt about it at the time. So I'd always refer... No, it's probably not.
Tell me about the cuisine.
I don't want to pin it down, but like it's impossible to, it's like modern cooking that people are doing.
Cool. How did you finance all these places?
As I said, so this is the beautiful thing.
Well, right. You talked about your husband's investment.
Yeah. So I just rolled everything back
in. First one.
I have no investors. It's all mine, which I think is probably, I don't know if it's unique, but it's got to be damn near unique. Everything got rolled back in. The Hoof and Cocktail Bar paid for Rum. And I took out a loan against the businesses to pay for Grey Gardens. And it's almost after a year, you know, we're paying that loan back at an amazing quick rate. So
good for you.
Yeah, I highly recommend that model. I understand it's not available to everyone. And I don't know that you could still open a restaurant even in Toronto for $70,000. I mean, if a place already has washrooms and a bar, like that's the advice that I would give to young women looking to open their own restaurants is don't try and do a build out. Like I can do a build out now. You know, and we don't talk about money enough. I built Grey Gardens for
I say that all the time, yeah.
For $500,000, just under $500,000, which I think is pretty good. To go from like $70,000 to $500,000 in 10 years is it's pretty good. But I don't think everyone can do that.
No. So Jen Egg, what do you think you were put on this planet to do?
Raise hell. I don't know. Have a good time. Drink good wine. Talk about shit.
Good answer.
Thanks.
Anyway, it's been fun getting to know you.
Same, same, same. Thank you so much, Carrie.
All right. Thank you. You're the bomb, Jen. We're going to take a break for a word from our sponsors. Then we'll be right back with Christine Barbaric of Refinery 29. Does this happen to you? You need a dozen eggs, you go to the supermarket, you head to the egg section, and you are so confused by what you find there, you freeze. You want nice eggs on hand because maybe you want a cheese and herb omelet for dinner, or you want to poach an egg to slip on your avocado toast, and you know quality eggs make a big difference. And you're a decent person, so it's important the chickens have a good life. But as you stand there, you think to yourself, I have no idea what all these words on the egg cartons mean. So you shrug, pick one, and continue shopping. Stop right there. You are a busy lady. You don't need this bullshit in your life.
You need bull-free eggs, which is where Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs come in. Their pasture-raised hens roam outside in 108 square feet of space per hen. Those cage-free hens, they never go outside. I tasted the difference once I tried Vital Farms eggs. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. It's time for our Bob's Red Mill Minute. Since it's the end of the year, I thought I'd focus on two easy celebratory recipes that you can make for any New Year's Eve celebration. Both are from the Cherry Bomb Cookbook. First, the gougère recipe from Melanie Dunay, the tremendously talented photographer. Gougères are so easy and fun to make, you should give it a try. You need milk, butter, salt, eggs, Gruyere cheese, nutmeg, black pepper, and flour. Bob's organic, unbleached, white, all-purpose flour perfectly fits the bill. You can use the same flour to make Chef Tanya Holland's garnet yam pancakes with creme fraiche and caviar. These are so addictive and delicious. It's one of those appetizers that will have your guests hanging out in the kitchen, lining up for the next batch. There's still time to shop at bobsredmill.com with our special code, CHERRY25. Use it at checkout for 25% off your order. You know with Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. Bob, you're the bomb. Let's return to the show. Next up, Christine Barbaric, the global editor-in-chief and co-founder of Refinery29. Christine recently gave birth to the most beautiful baby girl, so congratulations, Christine. A lot of people don't know this, but Christine worked at Gourmet Magazine during the early years of her career, and she talks to us about life at the legendary food magazine. As I mentioned, we recorded this interview in April. Enjoy our conversation. One of the fun things about the podcast is you really get to learn about people you admire. And I realized I don't know that much about your pre-Refinery 29 life, except I do know you worked at Gourmet, and that is part of why we have you here today.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely a seminal time for me.
How did you get to Gourmet?
Gourmet.
God, you know what I just realized?
What?
And I'm going to leave this in.
What, Carrie?
I bet half of our listeners know what Gourmet is, and I bet half of them don't.
Oh. Anyway, Gourmet Magazine was not my first choice. I was actually the personal assistant to Steve Florio, who is now deceased, sadly, but he was the CEO of Condé Nast. I was his personal assistant.
He was a legend.
Yes.
I can't even imagine
what
it was
ways.
Like being his personal assistant.
Well, we met at The New Yorker because I was an assistant at The New Yorker, which was also a dream job. But then he sort of secretly told me that he was moving over to Condé Nast, and he sort of alluded to the fact that I would have any job I wanted if I just, you know, sort of worked with him for 2 years. He had a secretary, but he really needed someone that was young and that was really knew a lot about magazines, indie publications, everything. And I was so well read. And, you know, at that point, you remember, like, there were so many cool zines out there. There was Might, there was Detour, there was just like, there was, you know, ID. It was just like, there was just so much mojo. It was such an exciting time in magazines, and I read everything. And I think he knew that. And so I decided to go with him. And, you know, around the 2 year mark, I told him I wanted to start interviewing. He didn't really give me any sort of like help, and other than just allowing me, giving me permission to interview. And those magazines were so competitive. The ones I wanted to work for were the ones, or work at, were the ones that had a very long legacy of great journalism. I didn't go to journalism school. I went to school for creative writing. I didn't learn a lot of the sort of practical skills that you needed to make long form content, you know, produce a feature, work with a great, you know, award-winning writer, understand how to negotiate with them over, you know, ideas and words and language. And I just didn't know any of that stuff. And I wanted so badly to be an editor. It was my dream. And Gourmet was also one of those magazines. They used to, you know, in sort of, you know, really kind of like delving into their archives, they did columns called Bachelor Chef, and they had like incredible writers in the 50s write about what it was like to be a single guy cooking on their own. And that's where I discovered Lori Colwin, you know, who like brings tears to my eyes. I mean, I had like a library of books that I had to read, you know, coming into Gourmet that were just, they were just sort of institutional in terms of, you know, books that you needed to know. And I read everything that she wrote. And anybody out there that doesn't know Lori Colwin, She died tragically, you know, quite young, but she did this book called, I actually feel like I'm getting emotional. I'm like getting so sad. I mean, because, you know, she was in her 40s, I was in my 20s, but she wrote this book called Home Cooking. And, you know, being in my 20s, she wrote so candidly about what it was like to be broke and living in New York City and like having friends over and entertaining with like a hot plate and making beautiful meals with nothing. And I just loved it because I had nothing. And I mean, look at me. This is so crazy.
You're going to start crying.
Does anyone ever cry on your show?
Often.
Oh, really? It's so crazy.
Home cooking and more home cooking were big inspirations on me. And I referenced them in the introduction to the Cherry Bomb Cookbook because I just loved those books. And I just loved the way she wove the recipe into her life and her life into the recipe.
Just like Ruth. Mm-hmm. Just like Ruth. I didn't really overlap very much with Ruth. We only worked, I think we were there at the same time for about 6 months, but, you know, obviously I was a huge fan of hers from her time at the Times.
But Lori was also a columnist.
Yes.
At Gourmet, and I remember all of a sudden the columns just stopped.
Yeah, it was just, I just felt really lucky that I got to sort of read her and know her in the very recent sort of shadow of her existence. And I think her writing, the way she wrote personal essays, is just such an inspiration to me now because I love writing personal essays. And I think that there is just such an important time to be vulnerable in our writing, especially as women and our experiences. Anyway, I think that Gourmet was just really an education for me. I call it my journalism school because I had gotten into debt in my early 20s. Not even that much debt. I think it was like $5,000 of debt, but I was just so afraid of debt. I decided to move back in with my parents. So I was commuting for the first 2 years I worked at Gourmet from Long Island, 2 hours each way. But what I would do, this is so funny, they sort of guarded the transcripts of all of the features and all of the stories, like in these like locked cabinets. But I worked for this incredible woman, Rebecca Innocencio, who was the managing editor there for a very long time. And she was a great mentor to me. She gave me access to those cabinets. And so I would take the stories that I loved, take the whole folders, the whole binders. I mean, if anyone ever knew this, it's like so illegal. But I always return them, and I would read every phase of the manuscript from beginning to end. Sometimes I would take them on the train, and that was how I really learned how to edit. I would see, you know, these incredible, Elaine Richards, who is the features director there, and she really top edited a lot of the senior editors who had different sections of the magazine. And, you know, when I finally got to the point where I was editing Gourmet Entertains, which is like 1,000 recipes, you know, and I used to edit David Rosengarten and Jane and Michael Stern, who are just a delight to work with. But I think that when I got to read the rigor in the margins of those stories and really learned about how the role of an editor, how they worked with great writers, I just really blossomed in that. And I didn't even have I think you and I have spoken about this. I didn't have a particular interest in food. I had a particular interest in how food played a role in life and in our traditions and our family and our rituals, which is why I love the role that it plays when we travel, we eat, and we experience that place through the meals that we have. And I know that you can appreciate this. When I was sort of coming of age at that time and learning how to become an editor and really being trained, there was a requirement of all editors that you had to take 3 restaurant meals somewhere in New York City, wherever you were, didn't matter the cost, it was like a requirement. And then you had to just sort of like report back to the team how they were, how the service was, how the food was, and you did not mess around. You were not like going to, you know, Bear Burger. You were like going to go to Montrachet or La Grenouille or JoJo.
Wait,
or
yes. Oh my God, that was the day of the big budget.
I know. Chanterelle. I mean,
monthly you were expected.
Three meals on Gourmet's dime. And it was just a really beautiful, albeit indulgent, practice, but it really did discipline you to pay attention to great, you know, restaurant experiences. And that was such an epic time for French food in New York. And I didn't know anything about French food French cooking. I mean, Chanterelle was, I don't know, it was an awakening for me going there, and because it wasn't just about the food, it was about the pacing of the courses and the size of the portions, the, you know, the, just the kind of attitude of the wait staff. And also, you know, the owners would come out and they would just be, they would greet everyone at every table. It was just such an elegant and just beautiful kind of experience to have. So I learned to appreciate food, and I also worked in the kitchen a lot because when we worked on Gourmet Entertains, we had to be partnered with a food editor. So you had to really be in the kitchen observing, you know, how they were adapting recipes to really understand how they got to the final phase and, you know, for publication. And let me tell you, it's like, it seems like it was an awesome experience, but, you know, I realistically and just honestly, I gained about 45 pounds. Yeah, I know. You can see Carrie's face right now. And I remember going to the dentist and him, my dentist at the time, saying, you know, you've never, looking at my, he had, you know, been my dentist for so long, and he was just like, you've never had this many cavities. He's like, are you eating between meals? I'm like, I'm eating constantly. All I do is eat. All I do is eat. And it was just like, because when you're, we had to test, I think, every recipe like 6 to 8 times. But for Gourmet Entertains, it was, you know, 12 recipes sometimes if it was Thanksgiving. So you can do the math. I can't do the math. But I do remember the breaking point for me was, it was a holiday issue. It was, I got the brownie feature. It's so funny. I hope everyone's laughing because it sounds absurd, but it was like 20 brownie recipes and 8 times I had to taste them. You had to taste them every stage. Oh. And I was just like, enough.
Did you ever eat a brownie again?
Oh, I love brownies. I do, but I just think that, and now I'm gluten-free, which is the funniest part of all of it, is just that I don't eat gluten anymore. So I'm always really curious about finding great ways to, you know, eat delicious things without gluten, but that would have happened. I would have like been dead in the water at Gourmet if I was gluten-free then.
So few follow-up questions to the Gourmet years. When Ruth got there, when Ruth Reichel joined, you said you only had a few years working
under
Ruth.
No, months.
Oh, months.
Yeah, only about 6 months. I think it was like 5 or 6 months that we overlapped.
How did things change when Ruth got there?
You know, it was really exciting about her. And, you know, all respect to Gail Zweigenthal, who was the longtime editor before her. But I think that that magazine had grown a bit dusty. And that is sort of it's a blessing and a curse to have that kind of legacy attached to your title, is that you feel such an allegiance to it that there's no room for newness. And she was really part of this new guard, but she also had a foot firmly in that history. She knows food, new food, or still knows food better than maybe anyone, and had such a fair assessment of it, you know, a fair sort of look at it. And also, Ruth was kind. She was kind and very down to earth. She was very human. There's something, especially at that time, and I think still is, very elitist about good food and very precious, which I find really irritating because it does alienate and exclude a lot of people from appreciating it and the joy that it can bring to people's lives. And she just had a really great way of bringing things down to earth. I think she also brought like a really fresh slate of writers and voices, and she experimented a lot. She took a lot of risks. I mean, she is a brave woman, and I think she really knows herself. And that's like such a beautiful quality in an editor, someone that knows how to identify the special thing in another person's talent or voice, but also knows it in themselves. And she was really fun to have lead editorial meetings. She was just not scary. And meetings before that had, you know, were really tense and a bit scary. It was like, God forbid you didn't go to the right school or say the right word or use the right term. And I remember feeling like I had gotten punished for saying the wrong thing in a meeting once, and then sort of was relegated to the library to spend hours answering mean letters from readers about foie gras, about our sort of, you know, irresponsible use of foie gras in a recipe. And it was just kind of like that. It was sort of feeling like you were in private school getting scolded. She changed that, and she's, you know, she just has a very different kind of attitude, and it was smart, you know, to bring her on board. So it was,
I love her so much.
It was a tragedy to fold that magazine because I think it could have really continued to develop and evolve and play a role in young people's lives.
All right, tough task. And you have 1 minute. Tell us about food coverage on Refinery 29.
Food coverage is so exciting. I have a big shout out to Zoe Bain and also Aletra Wiedemann, who I think has been on your show. And she really launched our food content. I love her work at Impatient Foodie. I was a big fan of hers. And I really credit her with recruiting Zoe Bain, who oversees our food and lifestyle coverage with a small team. Also, my former assistant, Elizabeth Buxton, is on that team. She moved over there. She loves food. And we really try to look at food through a millennial lens and a Gen Z lens. And it's really about looking at trends in food shopping, you know, from Trader Joe's to, you know, shopping at Target. And I think also like food hacks, making lunch. I think that there's a real interest in making good food, nourishing food, but also obviously doing it on a budget. And I just really love learning about the stuff that inspires, like we could do mason jar lunches, like, you know, till the end of time, and, you know, our users would never get bored of it.
So if you haven't looked at Refinery 29's food coverage, go check it out. It's always fun, beautifully photographed, and wildly useful.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome. Well, thank you for taking the time away from your very busy job to swing by the studio.
Anytime.
Christine, you're the bomb.
You are the bomb too, Carrie.
Bye.
Bye.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to Christine for sharing her memories about Gourmet. You're going to be hearing a lot about the legendary magazine in 2019 because Ruth Reichel, the former editor-in-chief and best-selling author, has a memoir coming out this spring about her time at Gourmet. I just finished an advance copy of the book, and I could not put it down. Thanks also to Jen Ag for spending time with us. If you are in Toronto, make sure to stop by one of Jen's spots and tell her the Bomb Squad sent you. Thank you to our sponsors, Bob's Red Mill, Vital Farms Pasture-Raised Eggs, and Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb. We wouldn't have a show without them. Special thanks to our associate producer and our very own Riot Girl, Jess Zeidman. Jess, if I don't tell you enough, you're the bomb. And thank you to the band Tra La La for the best theme song in the world. If you are in Brooklyn on Wednesday, January 9th, come to Books Are Magic. I'll be interviewing Katrina Van Wyck about her new book, Super Powders, Adaptogenic Herbs and Mushrooms for Energy, Beauty, Mood, and Well-Being. Who does not need that? I'm excited to talk to Katrina and learn more about this subject. So come on by and hang out with us. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. That's it for 2018, and I am glad this year is over. It was a tough one, personally and professionally, but Radio Cherry Bomb has been a bright spot all year long. Thank you for listening each week and for being part of the Bomb Squad. I'm so thankful for each and every one of you. You really are the bomb. Talk to you in 2019.
I'll have what she's having.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.